Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 8 of Season 10 of Movie Our Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic, The Taking of Palom 1-2-3, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Stephen J. Rubin, a producer, a podcaster, a screenwriter, a film historian, and an author. Welcome back, Steve.
Great to be here. Rob, this is so much fun for me because we're revisiting a title which I constantly watch. It's not like I have to be reminded of a classic movie. This is so much fun for me.
Me too. That's why it is being given the Movies by Minute treatment. There's a reason for it. There's a method to this madness. Sort of.
So, nobody on this planet is doing what you are doing, Rob.
Of course there are. Well, no one's doing this movie, but there are hundreds of Movies by Minute podcasts.
There are?
Yeah, sure. There's as of the last count, there's like 260 different podcasts that do this.
I had no idea. Well, you certainly are the John Wayne of Minute by Minutes.
Well, I mean, I am. It is unique. I'm the only one who has Stephen J. Rubin on three of my seasons. So there you go.
And to quote the Duke, I think you're terrific.
Thank you. All right. So Minute 8 begins with Gray closing the door and ends with Brown turning off a light. So we ended things yesterday with the tension building. We're starting to get an idea of who these four hijackers are, even though only three of them are on the train at this point. And we're they're slowly raising the tension because we don't 100% know everything that's going to be transpiring over the next hour and a half of this movie, a little more, hour and 40 minutes of this. Well, no, the movie's an hour and 40. Yeah, a little more than an hour and a half that's left of this movie. And again, we're only 8 minutes into it. But, it's definitely done really well. And Gray then closes the door in between, the two cars. And then we get a nice shot of Green, who is still wiping his nose again. But you can see the look on his face that he's still not 100% sure if he really wants to be in this place or not. And I like we talked a little bit about this yesterday, that the way that all four of these guys are completely different, in their reactions, in their in the way that they prep for things and the way they act and everything. And, we're supposed to feel some type of sympathy for Green, even though at the end of the movie you realize that you're not supposed to, but throughout the movie you feel that he's this this guy that for whatever reason Mr. Blue decided to add him onto this onto this heist because of his expertise.
Right. He's there because he knows the subway system. He knows how to.
Yeah, you have to know who you can trust. Yeah. That's the thing.
Right. Exactly.
You're not just going to take someone because, they have a particular skill. You have to look at everything around it. You have to say, okay, he has this skill. This is what we need. He has this idea of, turning off the dead man switch. Great. But, it always makes me wonder, and it's been a while since I read the book, so I don't know if the book dives into this or not. Maybe you have a better recollection. But does the book explain about anything that happened before the hijacking itself?
Well, to be honest, Rob, I have not read the book, so I can't answer.
You said you read the book.
No, I hadn't read the book. I want to talk a little bit about Martin Balsam, though. Martin Balsam's career is playing basically average, decent guys. Not too intellectual, kind of a working stiff type. He won the Oscar, I think, in 1966. I think he was on camera for 10 minutes in a Jason Robards movie called A Thousand Clowns.
A Thousand Clowns, yes.
And he was, whatever those 10 minutes were, they were enough to get him an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor that year. He's also the foreman in 12 Angry Men. We talked about 12 Angry Men in the last show. I liked him very much in another thriller, which is about also mid-60s, called The Bedford Incident. He plays a ship's doctor on Richard Widmark's missile destroyer. Also kind of, you know, just kind of in this case, an average Joe who's been divorced three times kind of ducks back into the Navy Reserve to just stay afloat, no pun intended. But I've always liked Balsam, and he's a very accessible actor. He doesn't overpower you, and I think he's perfect in this cast because he's one of the more accessible people. You know, yeah. Earl Hyndman's character, Mr. Brown, barely talks.
And when he talks, because of his stutter, you don't really know what he really means every time.
Right, right. And Hector Elizondo, all he does is biting cynicism and criticism and all the schisms. And then, of course, you've got Mr. Blue Robert Shaw running things. He's the primary spokesperson between him and Matthau. But I liked Martin Balsam, and he's also very, by the way, he's also very good in a mid-60s thriller, which you know, called 7 Days in May.
Yes, of course.
He plays the president's main advisor. And so Balsam's been around forever, and to me, always good.
And you neglected to mention that he was also in Psycho.
Right, that's right. Memorably walking up the stairs at absolutely the wrong time.
Yes, for sure. What was the name of the other movie from the Bedford Incident?
Bedford Incident. Oh yeah, no, that is.
All right.
Now,
see, you've given me something else to check out.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I like talking to you. You always, you know, give me some. Hints on movies that I should try and check out.
Yeah, you know, that's my job.
I feel that's my job too. So you know it's paying it forward from that perspective.
Sure.
Yeah. So at this point, we see that Mr. Green is just sitting there calmly, and then we see the train coming into the station. And it's interesting because now there's a lot more people waiting in the station than there was before. You know, besides Mr. Blue and you know the black guy who confronted him earlier. You know, so there's a whole group of other people that are there. The train stops, and I gotta say the first shot when the train stops, in my opinion, is amazing because we see Mr. Blue completely in focus, and we see the train on the left side of the screen out of focus. You know, and normally, you know, it's not a question of it something being far away, something being close, whatever, but it makes it seem as if the train is that much further away from where it really is. You know, and he's just going to pivot and get to the train. I mean, that's how close he is. But I like the way that they do that shot. And then they show him watching other people get onto the plane. I get onto the train. We see a woman carrying a cello, which is an interesting little touch that they add here for the whole thing. And you know he waits until almost everybody is inside the train, and then he quickly turns around and walks towards the front of the train where the cab of the driver is. And as he's walking, you see that the doors are still open to the train, and he quickly spots and acknowledges Green along the way, meaning that, okay, we have the guy in place where he's supposed to be, which, again, is amazing visually because it's also telling us the relationship between where Mr. Green is sitting and where Mr. Blue is going to be very shortly. So then we know that they're directly parallel from one another with the way that the shot presents itself.
I give you credit, Rob. You have forensically digested this movie, every shot, every motion, feeling. You are a true connoisseur of film.
Thank you.
I've never done something as forensically as you've done here, but that's just me.
Okay, but that's the idea of what we're doing here, you know.
Right.
You know, it's what's the fun of it if you're not gonna go through every single thing that that you see on camera? I mean, you as a producer and a writer and someone who's been on so many film sets or whatever, you know that you know better than I do that the goal is that everything that's on screen has to have some sort of meaning. You're not just gonna have something for the sake of being on the screen if it isn't meant to be there, it doesn't need to be there, and whatever, you know, not just because of brevity, but because sometimes you want to express something that you have a way of expressing it where you don't need to be explicit, but if someone's paying attention, they're gonna say, oh, I noticed that. And you know, that's part of, from my perspective, what Movies by Minutes is. You know, it's the idea of, okay, let's just focus on this 1 minute and see everything that we can try and figure out, and what possibly the, you know, the director, the writer, and, you know, what were they thinking when they did that particular thing. It could be that they were thinking nothing. It could be that it's just random. But on the
sometimes,
other hand,
sometimes it's serendipitous. I think that there are a lot of movies these days that have a lot of fat on them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of movies are way too long. The fact that the last James Bond movie, No Time to Die, was almost 2 hours and 45 minutes, or maybe even longer.
I think it was close to 3 hours, if I remember correctly.
Close to 3 hours. That is insane. You know, we're watching tape. We're focusing on the taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. There ain't any fat on this body here. This is a tight, edited, pulsating, I've used the word pulsating a few times, thriller. And enjoy it, because you're not getting that in a lot of big studio movies right now, which have too much fat on the bone. They've got to get editors in there that are trained to trim.
Is it because they want things to look more showy? You think that's why it is? Because, you know, because if you're talking about an action movie, they want to have a lot more stunts, a lot more explosions and stuff like that. But I don't know.
The action sequences are going on way too long, just forever. We went to see the new Mission Impossible, which of course is the quintessential action movie in Hollywood these days.
Yes.
And you know, it is nonstop, but the sequences went on forever. I mean, we talk about early James Bond movies, you know, that fight in the train compartment in From Russia with Love lasted probably, you know, 3 minutes. You know, you have action sequences in these big movies these days that last 10, 15 minutes, and it's just way too much.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree with you on that. You were right about No Time to Die. It is 2 hours and 43 minutes.
So, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. It's just, and then, of course,
the problem is, and I agree with you on it, when I was watching that movie, you felt that it was dragging. And in a James Bond movie, you don't want it to feel as if it's dragging.
Absolutely. You never want to look at your watch.
Nope.
And
not at all.
That's something that is just going on too long these days. I don't know what the story is. I think it starts with the writing. They've got to trim in the writing stage, and then directors are just given too much. Now, interestingly, you and I have talked about Tarantino's last film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That moved. There was no fat on that bone. And I think it was immensely aided by both the soundtrack and all those 60s references to commercials and radio jingles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that whole atmosphere of 1969 Hollywood was beautifully created so well. And it's a very, very terrific movie. I'm a little jealous because somebody is now doing a coffee table book about that movie, and I would have liked to have worked on that.
Okay. You just weren't quick enough.
Wasn't quick
next
enough.
Time, next time you got to be quicker, quicker on the draw, for that type of thing. But I mean, when I try and think of Tarantino movies, because he's the one who's writing them, I can't think of any Tarantino movie that drags at any point, because they're all always constantly moving. And like you said, when there's nothing really moving, he just has music that helps it move. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Because he pans through certain things with the music and stuff like that. So it's very, very cool the way that he does that. And again, if you look at his first movie, Reservoir Dogs, it's the shortest of all his movies. And, you know, in that movie, you know, you want to even see more than what you see. And so what he does is he describes it, which is just amazing. It's such an amazing idea. And that's why it's one of the best, you know, writing, directing debuts in film history, in my opinion, where, you know, someone just completely, no one even saw this guy coming.
No, I go back to his script for True Romance.
Correct.
Also, just a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Tarantino is a really fun writer.
He sold True Romance in order to be able to help fund Reservoir Dogs, that's for sure. And I'm a big fan of True Romance. I was actually contemplating, you know, doing that this season. That was one of my options of what I wanted to do. Have you ever
Can't
seen
go wrong there.
Have you ever seen the Tarantino cut of True Romance?
Probably not.
Okay, because in True Romance, in the original script, as Tarantino likes to do, he doesn't keep things in chronological order. So in the script, it's not chronological order. It starts with Alabama and Clarence on their way to L.A. to meet Richie.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then it has flashbacks showing everything that happened beforehand of how they met, you know, the whole thing with Drexler and all that stuff.
Interesting.
And the ending is very different also, because in Tarantino's ending, spoiler alert for anyone who didn't know this, Clarence actually dies.
Ah, okay.
You know, when he gets shot in the eye, you know, in the version that we all see, you know, the Tony Scott version, so he gets his eye basically gets skimmed, and you know he has an eye patch at the end, but he survived. But in the original script, he got shot in the eye, and Alabama then, you know, had to go on off on her own. And tidbit for people who are familiar with Reservoir Dogs, so they mention Alabama in Reservoir Dogs.
Oh.
She and Mr. White were a couple, and they were you know, working together on a whole bunch of jobs. Because that the whole idea was is Alabama was now this widow.
Ah, okay, there you go.
When he's telling Joe about the stuff that he's done in the past, he's, you know, Joe asks him, "How's Alabama?" And he goes, "Well, you know, we stopped working together because, you know, after a while that man woman thing just doesn't work anymore." Anyway,
got it.
So yeah, but again, Tarantino always has references to his other movies in his scripts. It's just great. And, you know, those would be fun going through one of these days. But
sure,
we'll have to see where they fall on my list eventually. I have a lot of other movies that I'd rather do first. So. Oh well. All right. So right now we you know we're getting ready for the train to start moving, and then Mr. Blue pivots and walks over to the conductor's cab, and just stands there, and the conductor gets a little antsy, and he goes, "Hey, how am I supposed to see with you?" And then he sees that Mr. Blue pulls out a gun, and we get some of the suspenseful music at this point. And, you know, obviously the conductor now knows that he's about to be hijacked. Now, I'm sure you know who the actor is who plays the conductor, right?
Matthew Broderick's father, James Broderick. Well, I always remember from a 1970s TV, or actually it might be 80s, TV series on ABC 70s. Called Family.
It was the 70s.
The 70s, right. And he played...
Family was from 76 to 80.
Okay, yeah, very, very... I think it was the show that introduced us to Christy McNichol.
That's right.
Seda Thompson, Meredith Baxter, Burney.
Yeah, I used to love watching remakes, or not remakes, reruns of that show.
Oh, yeah. No, James Broderick had a long career, and his look of befuddlement when all of a sudden he's facing an armed man is very realistic and pretty scary.
Yeah, and he doesn't know what to expect here and whatever. And then he says, "Holy God, what do you want?" And then Mr. Blue says, "I'm taking your train." He goes, "You're taking my train?" Like, what the hell are you talking about? You're taking my train. Where are you taking it? Benny, I can't remember his name right now. The Henny Youngman. We're not even talking about the Henny Youngman line of him saying, take my wife, please. It's, take my train, please.
There isn't much comedy here right now. This is literally deadly serious.
Yes. Well, again, it's because of the characters. They do an amazing job here of compartmentalizing the characters, meaning you have someone like Blue, who is completely straightforward in everything that he does throughout the entire movie. He doesn't break character. And then you have someone like Garber, played by Walter Matthau, or, you have Rico, Jerry Stiller, where the two of them are just cracking jokes the whole time also. And it's nice that each of them has their tone.
There was a bomb scare in, was it Brooklyn or the Bronx yesterday, but we found out it was a cantaloupe.
Exactly.
pretty funny stuff. Go ahead.
Yes. And well, it's pretty funny stuff for the 70s. Nowadays, people would look at it a little differently, but yes. That's fine. That's why this movie was made at the right time. I don't think this movie could have been made the way that it was made in any other decade than the 70s.
Right.
I think that every decade, if you look at it, would have changed it in ways that it wouldn't have landed so well. And again, that's partially why the 2009 remake just doesn't work at all from that same perspective, because something's off. With the way that the characters act and with everything that's going on and stuff like that,
for me,
post 9/11. So that also changes things.
Also, for me, Travolta as the lead villain doesn't quite work for me. I always think of John. I mean, how can I get Grease and Saturday Night Fever out of my head and Vinnie Barbarino? I mean, it's hard for me to accept John Travolta as a villain. Like it was hard for me to accept Tom Cruise as a German army officer in the Von Stauffenberg movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise is a terrific actor. I just couldn't get past the fact that it was Tom Cruise playing a one-eyed Nazi. So right. There you go.
It's true. And, he's Danny Doyle is the name of the character that James Broderick plays. And then we see Mr. Green stand up and walk towards the cab from inside. And then we see Bud looking around and he goes, "Hey," and he's also trying to figure out what's going on here with the whole thing. And then he hears behind him someone says, "Turn around, I got something to show you," and we can hear the stutter. And Earl Hyman does a really good job as Mr. Brown with that to show that this guy has a speech impediment, but he's still very good at what he needs to do here. That's not stopping him from being one of the guys in this heist.
Right.
And then Bud turns around and says, "What's going on? What is this?" And he goes, "Shut up." And then he reaches up and turns off the overhead light, which I don't really know why he did that. The only explanation that I can give of why he did that is, he doesn't want him to look at his face. But I don't know. I can't think of any other explanation, because I know that when you're driving, if you have the light on, so it makes it harder for you to see behind you.
Also, you've got all these hostages on the train car. They don't want to be too visible to them. So keeping them in the shadows is probably best.
Right. Okay. But they're all going to see who they are. These guys are not wearing masks, so. Right. The idea is that they're not wearing masks, but they're wearing disguises. And these disguises are amazing because they really do make them all look very differently. Very different.
Very different.
So it's very clever the way that they do that. And that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything to add about this minute as the tension keeps rising?
Just some great sparkling dialogue, which we've just witnessed, and it's going to keep building, and then we're headed toward that final moment where everybody on the train realizes that they've been hijacked. So,
Yeah, I mean that's only going to happen next week when you're not here anymore. But the main people on the train, the conductor and the driver are the ones who are going to get more of an idea
right.
about the whole thing. All right, excellent. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hijack Hump Day, where my guests will give their top five movies that deal with some sort of hijacking. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Well, I'd like to start with a Steven Seagal movie called Under Siege, where a group of hijackers hijack a U.S. Navy battleship. And it's, Steven Seagal, Steven Seagal's career kind of went into the toilet with a lot of grade Z thrillers. But back when he did this movie, after doing his first three movies, which were so terrific, I thought, Steven Seagal was going to be the next Bruce Lee or whatever. And it's a really terrific terrific movie done on a big scale by the director of The Fugitive, Andrew Davis. So that was my number five. I would put Speed up there as well, and that's where a bus gets hijacked in a way. It's not like armed men came on the bus, but Dennis Hopper rigs the bus so nobody can leave it, otherwise it'll explode. But if you haven't seen Speed from 94, I think it was 94.
Yeah, it was
It's funny,
94.
the first time I ever saw Speed, I was on my way to the movie theater with my wife, and on the radio was the O.J. Simpson slow chase down the 405 freeway in L.A. So I thought it was kind of ironic that I'm listening to the slow chase and I'm about to see a movie called Speed.
My favorite piece of trivia about Speed is from the TV show Mad About You with Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt. So
Right.
every so often they would have little scenes where they're just like throwaway jokes. And so they have an episode where he's going through his wallet because she's been driving him crazy that he needs to clean out his wallet. And he goes through his wallet and starts taking out all these little things, and he can't understand why he has all these different things. And he pulls out a little piece of paper and he reads it and he goes, idea for movie, bomb on bus. If it goes under 55, it'll blow up. And he goes, damn, I should have used that back then.
I have a couple of Die Hard movies. Die Hards are usually about some form of hijacking. In the case of Die Hard 4, the entire country is hijacked with these thieves who are taking over all the digital communications. And even though I don't generally think sequels are very good, I thought this sequel was terrific.
Okay, but
Timothy,
do you think that Live Free or Die Hard holds up today though? I
I
don't
just
think so.
watched it the other day. I've seen it like six times. I'm
No,
a
okay,
big
I've seen it more than six times, and I've broken it down minute by, or I did it 5 minutes at a time. And the parts of the movie are great, but parts of it are just too, they take away the Die Hard aspect of John McClane. And they try and turn him into a superhero, like a James Bond or an Ethan Hunt or something like that. And it just doesn't work as well as the first three. If this was a movie on its own and that wasn't connected to the Die Hard franchise, I think it would have been much better.
Interesting, interesting. I just like the fact that he matches wits so well with Timothy's character, and he takes on these French super crazy parkour experts, and
Oh, for sure.
it's just powerful. The other Die Hard movie to me is the first Die Hard, which of course they hijacked Nakatomi Plaza for their nefarious deeds, and then I'd say my number one would have to be Air Force One, the Harrison Ford movie. which is another really riveting thriller. If you haven't seen Air Force One, this is one hell of a movie.
Yeah. And I know there were a lot of polls, and James Marshall is usually at the very top of the best fictional presidents, you know, from movies.
Yeah. Harrison Ford was great. And that movie, and equally great was Gary Oldman.
Yeah, for
he
sure.
Was just marvelous. Mm-hmm. Marvelous. And I've gotten to know a number of actors, one of whom plays one of the main villains, who's one of the American turncoats in the movie. His name is Xander Berkeley.
Xander Berkeley. Okay.
Yeah, he may be an actor in my 12 Anxious Men movie if we get that remake going, or that spoof off going, because I've gotten to know Xander through Facebook. So those are my five choices.
All right, very good. I love all of those choices. Excellent. Okay, and we will now once again play the daily game of Name That Remake. So let us spin the wheel to see what movie remake Steve is going to have to try and guess. Let's hope that I can, you know, make the plot seem a little more interesting. Okay. All right. This is an interesting one. Again, it's one that I know you've seen. So I just now need to think of how I'm going to present it to you. Okay. So the original movie came out in 1948, and the remake came out in 1987. Okay, and the idea is that it's about a man that commits a murder and tries to pin it on an innocent man, but then he himself is the one who's being tasked with trying to find the murderer, who obviously it's himself.
Wow, it's not The Wrong Man. Is it The Wrong Man?
No, The Wrong Man came out in 1955.
Okay. You might have stumped me on this one, Rob. The original was 48.
Yep.
Okay. Wow.
I'll read you the IMDb blurb for the movie from 1948. A magazine tycoon commits a murder and pins it on an innocent man who then tries to solve the murder himself.
Okay. Yeah, you got me on this one.
All right, so now I will read to you the IMDb blurb on the remake, and we'll see if you can try and figure it out from that one. The Secretary of Defense forces a Pentagon naval aide to lead a spy manhunt.
Is that Kevin Costner and Gene Hackman? Is that
yes,
the,
it is. Is, yes, it
that
is.
That is the I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. It's what was the original called?
The original was called The Big Clock.
Oh, okay. And so the remake is I forget the name of the remake.
No.
Way Out.
Exactly.
Thank you. You got me.
Okay. The point here is not to get you. That's not. I'm not trying to get you here.
I'm
trying to get you to have, you know, to get all the joints in the brain moving to, you know, to talk about fun movies that were either remade or not, you know, in a good way or not. This one is an interesting type of remake because they do change a lot of the elements between them. So it's hard to say which one of them is better because the Big Clock is a good movie. But if I was pressed with having to give an answer, I think I would say that No Way Out is better.
I don't think I've seen who was in the original.
The original was with Ray Milland, Maureen O'Sullivan, and Charles Laughton.
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen the original, so that
okay,
probably
see,
made
now it I've now I've given you something to yeah. try and find and watch.
Very good.
There you go. All right, excellent. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Stephen J. Rubin?
Oh, I have two podcasts: Stephen J. Rubin Saturday Night at the Movies. That's JAY. And it's available on all the platforms. We also have a YouTube channel. And if you Google Stephen J. Rubin on YouTube, you'll find me. I also have a Facebook page, Stephen J. Rubin. I have a page for the James Bond movie encyclopedia. I'm on X, Instagram. So if you Google Stephen J. Rubin, you should be able to find me.
All right. And finding me is very simple. To do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Instagram. So, until tomorrow,
Gesundheit.